Off the Ball, GAA.
Honestly, I wouldn't have put Mark as the manager type. Now, Mark's been extremely, he's always been an extremely smart player, but in terms of that management role, I possibly would have seen him as a coach.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah.
I believe in my county, and I suppose they're good at football. They just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12. I love playing 10. I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No!
Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team. Thank you, France. Merci la France. Merci les baguettes. Merci les croissants. Je vous aime. I love you.
Hey! Hello, hello, and welcome along to Word on the Street, our 51st episode today. We hit the 50 mark and our 1 year anniversary last week, so very exciting times. I'm Susanna and Eve is alongside me as usual. How are you, Eve?
I'm good. It's less pressure and we've had the 50th anniversary, or the anniversary and the 50th episode out of the way.
That's true, and we got a shout out in our annual monthly, weekly Off the Ball meeting, so
you know, good going.
We're making waves. Rachel is not here today, but we do have a very special guest in the studio.
Hello.
Dara. Hello.
How are things?
Have you been on Word on the Street before?
I have.
You have?
Oh. Yeah. It was also to do with cycling.
It was. I was skiving off somewhere.
Giving away our episode.
Yeah. Spoilers.
My apologies.
It is to do with cycling. We'll get to that in a second. But thank you, Dara, for coming on, bringing us all your expertise. In the cycling world, it is National Bike Week, if you didn't know. And as part of that, we have former professional road racing cyclist and the 2021 Irish National Champion, Imogen Cotter, is speaking as an ambassador for Cycling Ireland Cycle Fest, a free, family-friendly festival taking place in Dublin Docklands this Sunday. The festival will feature a full programme of cycling events around Grand Canal Square, including family rides, BMX and polo bike demonstrations, and Cycling Ireland's National Criterium Championships. Registration is still open now at eventmaster.ie if you are interested. And we're delighted to say we actually have Imogen on the line now. Imogen, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
No, thank you for coming on. It sounds like a fantastic event coming up this Sunday. Can you tell us a little bit more about what people should expect if they're going to be around the Dublin Docklands area?
Yeah, well, I think it's quite a cool event in that there's kind of something for everybody, like, and every level of cyclists. You can, like, if you have kids, they can be in like the balance bike races. But then if you want to actually race yourself, you can take part in the National Crit Champs. You can test out bikes. Like, there's just something for every level of cyclist, which I think is quite cool, because sometimes cycling can feel a bit daunting to get into. So in this kind of festival, you can just try whatever you're open to.
Yeah, I was going to ask you why it's so important that we have events like this, but I guess you kind of answered it there. Is it that there's so many levels to cycling? And I think maybe people who have learned at a young age and just get on their bike every now and again don't realize the extent to which we have cycling at so many different levels in Ireland.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, it can sometimes feel like a sport that has a lot of barriers into it. Like, when you look at cycling, it can sometimes feel like it's such an expensive sport to get into. But I think with an event like this, you can dip your toe in, see what you're open to, like what you're comfortable with doing. And I think maybe open your eyes to the fact that cycling doesn't always have to mean like a 12 grand bike and racing. It can also mean, like, if you're a kid, just getting on and testing out your balance. And I think that's the best thing about it. Like, for me, cycling has been obviously a way of racing and like working, but before that it was like a way of getting from A to B. And I think it's just nice to see the whole kind of variety of cycling.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit about how you got into cycling? Because I know you were a runner, I think, before that. And was it you just cycled in a way to stay fit when you couldn't run, kind of thing?
Yeah, like a runner who was constantly injured.
Classic.
Constantly injured. And my dad had like a 50 euro turbo in our shed. And I would be like going out to the shed, just like no idea what I was doing, but putting on a movie and cycling on my dad's turbo. And then eventually, like, the way that I got into cycling as a job was basically that I tried out for a talent transfer program. So Talent ID is, I think it's kind of big in Ireland, but it's actually really big in the UK. And Cycling Ireland were doing a talent transfer program to see, like, if you were good at another sport, how would that translate over into cycling? And at the time, like you said, I was running beforehand. So I was decent at running, but never had a chance to get to, like, show how good I was because I was constantly injured. And then, yeah, cycling just became this way of, I was able to, like, I tried out for the talent transfer program. I ended up getting through each round, and it grew into something I never expected it to be. If somebody had told me when I was like 19, 20, even like 24, I would have been like, that I was going to have cycling as my job. I would have been like, what? But there's no way. I just hadn't ever entered my mind as something I would do for work, or like that I would race at an elite level. And yeah, it just turned into this thing that changed my whole life. It's been a really amazing, like, past 7 years.
I don't think people realize how common that is, Imogen, as well. Like, Orla Walsh was a very similar story in that she hadn't even really cycled at all until she was in her 20s. Obviously, she competed for Ireland on the track. And Lara Gillespie as well, like yourself, was a runner who tried her hand at cycling and turned out to be, you know, a world champion talent.
Yeah, it was funny. Like, at the time that I was doing the Talent ID program, it was at a time, there was like an influx of girls, like myself, Orla Walsh, Mia Griffin, Alice Sharp. There was like this group of us that came in to cycling through that talent transfer, and it ended up being a really successful, like, cohort of us that came in. Like, we went on to become national champions, or like make cycling our job, like, you know, be world tour, be continental level, and get paid to ride our bikes. And I think there's oftentimes with Talent ID that it's not successful, but at that time it just, like, was a really great group. I remember, like, feeling at that time when I was in that cohort that, like, okay, there's something special here. We were all really determined and just pushing each other. And yeah, I look back and it was a really special time.
And what was it about cycling then that kind of attracted you when you did start cycling?
That was my question also.
Well, what was it about cycling? I don't know. Like, I suppose, okay, like, when I was involved in running, I was kind of always paddling my own canoe. And then it felt like I came into Cycling Ireland through that Talent ID program. And all of a sudden, I was in this high performance elite pathway where people, like, really believed that I could be good, and they were putting the time and resources into it. And it just felt like all of a sudden I was thriving, because I'd wanted that for so long in running, but I'd never been able to get that. And then once I was put into a high performance environment, and I had all of these like coaches who I could ask questions to, and like these training camps, I was just, it made me thrive, really. I think as an athlete, I just loved high performance.
And was there a moment when you realized that cycling was something that you wanted to really dedicate your time to, as opposed to kind of maybe you're stepping away from running fully and you kind of thought to yourself, this is what I want to be doing?
I would say that I'm trying to think. There was like a few times when I knew I could be good at cycling. And one of them was when I was doing that kind of those testings to see if I could be on the national team. And I remember I went from doing in the first kind of test, I did like a 6 second max sprint. And then 6 weeks later, I followed a program and I came back to do that same test again. And I'd improved like 42% or something. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I must be kind of good at this. Like, that gave me kind of hope that I could be good. And then I went and I went and trained with Cycling Ireland. I got onto the national team eventually, trained with Cycling Ireland, and I got kicked off the team. Basically, well, not kicked off, but I was told I wasn't selected after I had basically been dedicating my life to it for a year and a half. And that was a real crossroads. That was probably the moment where I thought, okay, I'm either going to go all in on this and back myself, because now I'm out of the Cycling Ireland kind of hub. I'm going to go and I moved to Belgium. I just said, okay, I'm going to move to Belgium. I'm going to race my bike in Belgium and see what I can do there. So I suppose that was the moment where I made the conscious decision that I'm going to pursue this, you know, with everything that I have. And that's when I left Mallorca. I left the kind of hub that we had there, moved to Belgium, and just started working in like a bakery factory, putting cakes in a conveyor belt all day so that in the evening I could race my bike. So I suppose that was probably the most conscious decision. It actually had felt like up until that point, everything was just like, oh, this is the next step. Oh, I'll move here. I'll go and do this. And then that was probably the most conscious decision I made to like pursue it. Yeah.
Imogen, you speak about cycling so far with such love for it and a real passion for the sport. But obviously it's also something that I suppose has brought you a lot of pain over the past couple of years since the accident in 2022. I don't mean to immediately bring you back to a really traumatic time, but can you tell us a little bit about, I suppose, what happened, but also how you've maintained that love for the sport after something that derailed you?
Like, it's so funny because I do think cycling has brought me like this whole spectrum of emotions. Like, you obviously get to experience the most high highs, like winning a national championships, like, oh my God, getting selected to like represent Ireland. But then as with any like elite sport, there is so much heartbreak that goes along with it, which doesn't just mean like, you know, my own, obviously I had that awful car crash, like, which is what you're referring to, but like I had the really bad car crash. There's also so much heartbreak along the way of like a race that doesn't go your way, or like getting like, you know, not selected for the national team. There's so many things that go wrong. So I think that I can be grateful to cycling because it has shown me that whole spectrum of emotions. I've been able to like experience high highs and low lows that I don't think I would have had in like just a normal, I do in inverted commas, in like normal life that was outside elite sport. And I suppose like what has made me still love it is that I really found it was like a life raft for me. When I was going through all of that kind of turmoil after I had this really awful crash. So maybe I should give like some backstory.
Yeah, give us a bit of a context, because I've read about it, but I'm sure a lot of our listeners might be hearing of it for the first time. And it really is incredible that you're even here talking to us today in a way.
Yeah, no, it is. Like in 2022, I was out on a training ride and a driver who was driving on the wrong side of the road, he hit me head on at about, he was driving at about 60, 70 kilometers an hour and I was going about 30. So like the statistics say that I should be dead. And I'm very, very lucky that I'm not dead, thank God. But it was like a very life altering event. It needed a lot of surgeries and, you know, it changed me mentally, physically. I deal with like chronic pain. But it's just something that I've gotten used to and done a lot of therapy about. So I'm able to talk about it with a bit more ease. But yeah, I suppose that like the reason I can still love cycling now and talk about it so fondly is because I think throughout that time when I was, you know, that was my first year as a pro, when I had that accident in January 2022, I was 3 weeks into my first ever pro contract that I've been working towards for like 5 years. And it became for me, even then, if cycling wasn't able to be my job, it became for me like a life raft through all of this unfamiliar territory of like going in for surgeries, dealing with like insurance, you know, dealing with police. The only like constant normal thing that I had in that time was cycling and was training. So even if I wasn't able to race, I was getting up every day and like putting my leg that I couldn't move, putting that on a chair and cycling with one leg on the turbo trainer. So I suppose there was always just a way of clinging to my normality. And I use that, like, that's obviously a very extreme situation of, you know, elite sport and of, you know, near death experience. But I do think that humans are like that in general, that if anybody goes through something like traumatic and life changing, you try and cling on to what feels normal for you. And I think that was cycling for me, or training in general. So, I think I was just really lucky. I was very lucky in an unlucky situation, and it might have changed my relationship with cycling in that I was no longer interested in being super competitive anymore. I just thought like there's so much more to life outside of that bubble, but that I could still see it for what it was worth. And it had brought me such community and like peace at that time, I think.
You mentioned there that you weren't 100% interested in competitive cycling anymore. You did make this miraculous comeback for a little while. What was that kind of period like when you did get back into pro racing? I know you cited, psychological trauma as a reason that you did end up retiring eventually.
Yeah, I suppose like when I came back to racing, well, first of all, I think I kind of didn't give myself grace to say, don't go back. Like there's no, you don't have to do this. I think probably feeling a bit of pressure from my team as well. Like they had been so, they hadn't really put pressure on me to race. And then all of a sudden it was like August and they were like, well, you're back on your bike again. Let's go racing. And I suppose I didn't have the kind of backbone. Maybe that's the wrong thing to say. I just probably didn't have the people standing in my corner saying like, you don't have to do this. So I kind of just felt like it was one foot in front of the other and got back racing. And like you say, it was this like miraculous recovery, but I would be in the peloton shaking. It wasn't healthy at all. And I think if I could go back, I probably wouldn't have listened to me either. Like if I went back and I said, hey, you don't have to do this, I probably would have said, I'm doing it. But I wish that I had just had somebody say, take a break, you don't have to do that. So I went back and I was setting like PBs. I was really strong, but mentally I was just so spent. And I'd be in the team bus and girls would be like bitching about like, you didn't do the lead out properly. And I would just be thinking like, oh my God, we could all just die tomorrow. Like it doesn't matter anymore. So I think that it was this, like, I just had this complete mindset shift that just didn't align with pro sport anymore. You have to have this kind of win at all costs mindset, and I didn't have it, and that was okay. Took me a while to accept that it was okay, but it was.
Now that Wendy's has these new biggie deals, everyone in the family can get what they're craving, from nugs to JBCs. The parental units can get an $8 biggie bundle, the eldest who think they're so grown can get a $6 biggie bag, and the little one who can do no wrong can get a $4 biggie bites. Assuming they have a credit card. No, I'm kidding. We take cash too. $4, $6, and $8 biggie deals for the whole family. Only at Wendy's.
Price and participation may vary. Single items at regular price. Prices may be higher in Alaska, California, and Hawaii.
Cycling already is such a dangerous sport. It would have taken a lot of bravery to get back into a peloton. I don't know if people listening are familiar with what a peloton is when we speak about it, but it's
terrifying.
It is incredibly, incredibly dangerous. That must have taken some amount of bravery to even, get back on the bike and race at all.
Yeah. No, I remember there was a real moment where I knew that it was in my last race, but that was when I knew that I couldn't do it anymore. And I was actually in the neutral, still in the neutral zone. And I was standing or cycling beside Marianne Vos, and she was to my right. And I remember looking over at her and she was off, hands off the bars, chatting away to her teammate, having something to eat, so chill. And I looked down at my own hands that were my arms were rigid and shaking, and I couldn't swallow because I was so nervous. And I just thought hey, what am I doing? That I don't need to do this anymore. And like you say, it's that whole thing of, obviously a peloton is dangerous, but I also had I had PTSD from the crash that I'd had. So while I was in the peloton, I would also be thinking of the most violent things that could happen in a peloton. And it was just so unhealthy for me to continue racing. And I started therapy 2 days later. I just desperately found an EMDR therapist, which is specific for PTSD. And I, in my first meeting with her, I was like, hey, I don't know if I'm doing myself more harm than good if I'm still racing. And she said to me, you're taking five steps back every time you race. You're going there feeling strong and, I've built towards this, let's go. And then it's just back to square one. So I was really lucky that I had a great therapist and that I had great people around me at the time, and that it wasn't like, for me, like deciding to stop racing wasn't a traumatic and sad thing. I was like, hallelujah, next stage in life. I can't wait.
So, I mean, but by all accounts, it would have been very easy for you to then say, well, I'm done with cycling fully and I'm not going to get back on a bike at all. But when, after you made your decision to retire, what was, I suppose, the next moment where you maybe got on a bike that was for leisure, or you did a more low-key event, or you interacted with the world of cycling in perhaps a different way than you had done before? And what did that feel like?
I wouldn't probably be able to pinpoint a specific time, but I just felt like, I think I took maybe 3 months or something where I didn't really cycle a lot. And then I came back to Ireland in the summer, and always when I'm in Ireland, I feel like my relationship with cycling is so positive and not tied down to performance that much. And I think I had a gravel bike. I remember doing this ride, like not even looking at my Wahoo, going off roads that I wasn't even sure where they were leading, and just having these real moments of like, oh my God, this is why people do this. This is why, you know, this is why people love cycling. And it doesn't, you know, I actually was never able to imagine when I was racing. I would always be like, wow, what do people do if they're not racing? Like, I must be so sad when people retire. And then I retired and I was like, oh my God, I'm so stupid. People cycle to coffee shops and get cake and it's fantastic, you know? So I had these real moments of being able to do those relaxed things. Like, my dad cycles as well, so we'd be able to like go and get coffee and cake together. And there was just never any... never any performance tied to it. And now I can use cycling in a totally different way. Like, at the moment I'm training for a marathon, but like, I'm still able, I mainly cycle. I don't use it. I'm like, do maybe one or two run sessions a week, but like mainly cycling. And, you know, there's no pressure involved with it anymore. And I have to remind myself of that as well. If I'm like descending a hill and I'm like nervous, I say like, okay, why am I nervous though? Who am I trying to prove anything to? It's such a nice way to approach cycling now. And I think my love for it, there was probably a period when I first stopped where I didn't want to look at racing. I didn't want to know what anybody was doing. And now I'm just completely opposite. I want to like watch racing. I want to report on racing, like make reels about racing, but I don't want to do it. And I love it more because of that. So yeah, that was a long-winded way of responding to your question.
No, that's really interesting. It must be strange, like being an ambassador now for cycling and talking about it so much as you do and on your social media and stuff. Is it hard? Obviously, encouraging people to get into cycling in some form or another comes naturally to you because you love it so much and in everything you just described. But for people maybe stepping into that professional world, is there any part of you in the back of your brain that kind of screaming at them like, ah, don't do it? And not necessarily because of the accident, although I'm sure that's part of it, but even just the whole cycle of pressure that comes with it.
You know, I think it's such a small part of your life that you have to like grab with both hands. And I know that if I hadn't grabbed that period of my life with both hands, that I would regret it. And my partner, he's a professional triathlete. So I'm also exposed to like the professional sport world through that. And I do just think you have to like go at it 150%. It might only last 2 years, 5 years, if you're lucky, 8 years or something. And you just have to grab it and grab all the opportunity and like embrace it. And like I was saying earlier, like that whole spectrum of emotion, you just have to try and enjoy it all. So I wouldn't, like, I would probably, if it was a, you know, if I had a child or something and they wanted to get into it, I'd be like, oh, I don't know, it's very dangerous. But if I'm just talking to, you know, young girls, I'd be like, go for it. Cause like, there's no way, well, I personally think that like, what I've learned about myself through sport, I don't think there's any way I could have learned that through, I say again in quotation marks, normal life. I think it kind of pushed me to, you know, I would never have learned how strong I could be if I hadn't had this like near-death experience, which happened through sport. Or I would never have known how like resilient I could in that world. So I think I would encourage people to get into it, but just to also maintain their perspective on the real world, because you can lose sight of that pretty quickly.
Could I ask Imogen, sorry, about like, you've done a lot of work with the RSA and, you know, those kind of road safety initiatives. Have you come into contact or been in communication with many people that are similar to you that have had these accidents or know someone that has had these accidents? And how have you found those kind of interactions?
Yeah, I really, you know, by sharing my story, and like you said, with the RSA, I did the advert with them. I think by sharing my story, it opened up a communication with like a lot of people who'd had something similar happen to them, and which was, you know, I knew it was common, but all of a sudden I was realizing just how common it was. Like, people were every day messaging me like these awful, traumatic, heartbreaking stories. And I just had no idea how many cyclists had these incidents with cars or knew somebody who'd had accidents with cars. And it's been so heartbreaking, but in some way I really like that people feel A, that they will come and tell me these things, these like awfully traumatic, heartbreaking stories about their loved ones. But sometimes these comment sections on my page, they turn into like these almost memorial, you know, pages where we can actually see these people's names and like hear their stories. And I think for me, that's what I would like to get out of it. I think that there's a person behind every statistic we hear. And I think that often gets lost with people who aren't involved in cycling, but they're real like people, real humans who just want to get home, who are maybe out commuting to work or, you know, cycling for fun on the weekends. And I like being able to put names to those statistics, because they are like, we know so many people in Ireland. I know people who've lost loved ones, you know, who have had serious traumatic life-changing injuries themselves, and they're real people. And I think that's the most important thing. That's the kind of message that I would always try and stress, that if I am talking to drivers, if I have the opportunity to talk to drivers, like, we're all just like people like you who are just trying to get home. And maybe you might think we're in the way, or maybe we might hold up your Saturday drive, but we're way more scared than you are in your car. We are scared for our lives, you know? So it's been, I think being able to share my story has like been able, I've been able to like connect with a way wider community as a result.
You mentioned there about like comments that you get, and you have such a huge social media presence. And I was looking through your old blogs, and I was looking through your Instagram right now, and it's such a positive place for the cycling community. And you have such a huge kind of devoted following now that are keeping up with what you're doing. What was it like kind of transitioning to almost becoming like a cycling influencer, if that's the right word that I'm looking for? But you have a real platform now.
Yeah, well, I suppose like when I first started cycling and I was doing the talent transfer stuff, I just started sharing random things. Like, you know, I didn't really know what I was actually sharing, but I felt like I was kind of starting this journey. And I thought, well, it could be interesting for me to look back on, but also like maybe people will be interested. And it's just developed into this incredible community. And I feel so grateful for that. And like you say, it feels really kind of, it still feels like people are on this journey with me. I think when I stopped racing for a while, I was thinking, oh, what will I share? Like, what will people be interested in? But all of a sudden now I've kind of made a pivot towards trying to get more into cycling journalism and cycling media. And that's also now become like a different pathway for me. And, you know, I feel really grateful that people still want to follow along with that, because, when I stopped racing, it felt a bit like for a time, oh, what is my story on here? And now I feel like I'm finding my feet and I know what I want to do now with it. So it's a lovely little corner of the internet for me.
You do a lot of advocating for road safety, obviously, here today and on your Instagram as well. It struck me when you were answering Dara's question and about drivers having to be aware that cyclists are there. I'm half Dutch, so when I'm over in Holland, I cycle all the time. I cycle everywhere. I grew up cycling, but I am terrified to get on a bike in Dublin traffic. I never go near it because the cycle lanes as well, you're going along them and you're actually bumping up and down quite physically because there's so many holes and chipped paint. Do you think it's realistic to dream of a time where, you know, a girl going to school or a boy could get on their bike and not be terrified in Dublin or further afield that they're going to be knocked down by a car or anything or fall off their bike? Because it just really feels like, I know the government have plans in place and they talk about it a lot, and we've seen kind of one-way streets come in Dunleary and cycle paths and stuff like that, but you can still only go so far before you have to get in a bus lane or whatever it is. Do you think there is a realistic chance that we could see Ireland becoming more like a Holland in the future almost?
I mean, that's a dream. Yeah. I feel like Belgium and the Netherlands take it to like an extreme. It's so fantastic. I absolutely love it. My fiance is from the Netherlands, so I visit there a lot, and I'm always like, wow, these random small roads are just connected with a bike path. It just is so mind-blowing to me. But I think there kind of has to be an overhaul almost from like, I can't even begin to imagine how we do it in Ireland, which is kind of depressing. But, you know, there's so many cycle paths that end out of nowhere. You know, you'll be on a safe cycle path, you'll think this is great, and then all of a sudden you get to a roundabout and you're like, okay, or this footpath ends and you're just, oh, I'm merging with traffic now. And I think that brings a lot of confusion for like the cyclists and the drivers. Like the drivers also don't know, are the cyclists going to hop onto the road now? Like, so there needs to be a like cohesive, like a pathway, like where everything is connected. At the moment, it's just like random like bits everywhere around Dublin. And I also would not ride my bike in Dublin city centre. It looks insane. And I think the thing that I would say about bike infrastructure now is that like it paint is not protection. It needs to be a physical barrier between a car and a bike. And I know that like requires huge investment for like infrastructure. I'm not naive, but there's no way that you can try and make somewhere like Dublin city centre less reliant on cars when you're not having that physical separation between the car and the cyclist. And I was cycling in Vancouver. My sister lives there. I was visiting her. They have the best bike paths. They're like completely physically separated. And it shows that it's possible. You know, it takes years, I'm sure, like years and years, maybe decades of planning and building, but it is possible. But there has to be the actual get up and go, or like the government or the people in government who can make that happen have to actually want it to happen, because they're thinking, well, there's not demand there now, you know, there's not people enough people cycling for us to warrant doing that. People aren't cycling because it's not there. Like, people feel like if I go cycling in Dublin city centre, I'm risking my life.
Yeah,
why would they cycle? So yeah. I think that just so much disconnect, and like maybe people in the government who were making, I don't even know how it works, but I'm assuming like people in the government who are making those decisions maybe aren't even cyclists, you know, maybe they don't have like a cyclist representative on board who can say to them, actually having a painted line on the road is scary for me, it's not enough. And yeah, I just don't know how we can change it, to be honest.
Yeah,
I was on a couple of years ago now, I was on a kind of like a, not a board, but there was an RSA initiative to, you know, hear the voice of the youth when it comes to cycling and road safety. And there was, you know, ministers there, and it felt like finally that was starting to happen, that connection between cyclists and people and young people in general was starting to be bridged a little bit. But to be honest, not much has happened since in terms of actual action, in my view, at least. And yeah, I couldn't agree more that it just seems like there's a bit of a disconnection there. And beyond that as well, there's a bit of apathy as well, I think, to be honest.
Do you think, the question for both of you really, that I don't really know the connection between maybe people hopping on their bike at a young age and being able to cycle to school and then potentially somebody representing Ireland in the future in road racing. But I do know there's a lot of Dutch cyclists and a lot of people cycle at a young age in Holland. Do you think if there was better infrastructure and more people were able to just go out and cycle to school even, that we would see more representation and even more success at a top level then?
Yeah, well, if you look at the current Irish pros, just looking at the women's, they're all from rural areas. So you've Lara Gillespie's from Carlow, and then she spent a lot of her life in Wicklow. Mia Griffin's from Kilkenny. Like, I can't think of any that are from, you know, Dublin.
Yeah.
So I think that's not a coincidence. I don't think.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with you on that. Like, I don't think that you're going to have people who, if you're not building up those like little skills that you can build when you're a kid and you're riding your bike, you know, and I think it about Dutch people that they kind of grow up and they know, because they've been riding their bike since they were five, they know how it moves. They know like how you can lean it and all of these things about cycling that for me at like, you know, starting to ride at 23, 24, you have to learn it. Again, like you have to learn in a completely different way. I do think that you are way more able to build as a cyclist if you're actually doing all of those movements and like little things like when you're a kid, you know, bunny hopping. I mean, just all these small things that you learn when you're a kid that aren't as daunting, but then when you have to learn them as an adult, they feel terrifying. So I do think, yeah, and there is stuff happening for cyclists. And I think there's so many amazing female cyclists, like you were naming them there, and Fiona Mangan, who had an incredible result yesterday in Navarra. Like there are so many things happening for the best female cyclists in Ireland that are showing these young girls, hey, look, it's possible that like, you can be one of the best in the world. But like the young girls of Ireland then need to be able to see, okay, what are the little stepping stones? And of course, we have things like there are initiatives through Cycling Ireland, you know, and races for like under 14s, under 16s. And we just need to keep on like laying out those pathways and making them really accessible and clear. I'm talking to young girls because I'm a female, but like, you know, also to young boys as well. But we have to show those girls like, hey, it's possible. And this is the pathway you need to follow. And this is how Mia made it, Fiona made it, Lara made it, whoever, and Cuivo O'Brien and all of these incredible cyclists that we have, this is how they did it. And you can do it as well. But there has to not be this complete like disconnect between getting girls on their bikes at like, you know, learn to ride when you're a kid and then all of a sudden you're 20 and you're a world tour pro. Like, what's the connecting line? And actually, I know that Cycling Ireland did it because I was one of the hosts for their like Bike Like Me program. I would do like a session on Zwift once a week with young girls during like 2020, 2021. And we'd just like ride our bikes and chat on Zoom for an hour. And I think that through those initiatives, like, and through providing like a bit of a structure to these young people who are coming through the sport, you can like bridge that gap for them, I think.
Do you have any other questions, Eve, before we
I suppose just
up?
To ask on a final note, like, what's next for you? Like, what are you kind of up to in the next few months on your cycling journey?
Running
journey now, exactly. Good luck in your upcoming marathon.
Yeah, well, I actually haven't picked a marathon yet. I'm like still training towards a marathon with no end goal in sight. So at the moment, I'm really trying to shift my focus from being like a cycling influencer to actually getting more into like broadcasts and media. Like my goal is to, I really would love to be in like cycling presenting a bit like, you know, Orla Shenhuy. I love what she does. I really admire her. And like Hannah Walker, there's loads of women in the area that I want to get into that I'm really looking up to. I'd love to be involved a bit more with like the Tour de France fam and maybe being able to do some commentary on that. Recently I was in Turkey like doing commentating for the first time on a men's race, but one of my big goals for this year is to get to commentate on a women's cycling race. I would really love to do that. And I'm just trying to pick up as much experience as I can because I've totally shifted my focus. I was doing a master's in journalism and I just have realized that maybe sharing like the, here's a picture of me smiling on a bike. Of course that has value sometimes, but I want to be able to show people like, hey, and this is what's happening in sport at the moment. Aren't these like women so amazing what they're doing in cycling and da da da. I want to be able to continue promoting women's cycling. I feel really passionately about that at the moment. I think I'm realizing how little women's sport maybe gets covered. Like I think it accounts for 15% of overall reporting in sports coverage. And that makes me so mad. And it's becoming something that I'm more and more aware of now because I'm getting into that area myself. So I think just using my platform as best as I can to promote women's cycling and break into that world of media and sports media and just commentating and cycling and everything to do with cycling.
We absolutely love to hear it.
Yes, indeed.
And like I was speaking to girls there before we started, Imogen, like cycling is, in the modern world is kind of a unique sport, similar to kind of tennis, in that it is so well supported across the board. Like, it, cycling is kind of just seen as cycling to a lot of cycling fans, as opposed to being a men's and a women's sport, essentially. But sometimes the broadcasting doesn't reflect that kind of appetite.
I mean, I was at Paris-Roubaix. I was actually commentating on Paris-Roubaix for the under... for the juniors and the under 23s, yeah. Like, that's only the men's under 23 and juniors. Like, there's no women's race there. And then there was the elite men. And so it felt like I went into that morning, I commentated on those two men's races, and then I came out and the elite men's race was on. I was in a cafe where there was only pictures of men racing. And I had this like rage. I can't tell you. I wanted to switch off all the TVs and be like, there's a women's race on right now. Like, you do realize that after all of these men have done their race, we're only going to get to see an hour of the women's race, and they are putting the same effort in. And, you know, I felt really frustrated then. I was almost like, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Are we going to complain that no one wants to watch women's cycling? So, you know, why are we going to pay them the same, or blah, blah, blah? And or are we just not going to show it? Like, you can't, your arguments become moot if you're not going to give them equal coverage, I think. And I just get so frustrated. And I think it's great that it's been highlighted more now. Like, after Paris-Roubaix, which is the race where that happened at, then Demi Vollering came out and said that, you know, women deserve more. And they do. They're putting in the same amount of effort. They're putting in, you know, and they're actually putting in the same amount of effort and getting paid, like, pennies in comparison to some of the men. And why are we accepting that? It's 2026. I feel so passionately about it. I'm so mad. I'm like, okay, maybe that was all right when you guys were like, you know, cycling's old school. Maybe, you know, 100 years ago that was okay, but move with the times. Like, these women are putting their bodies on the line for this. There's not enough research into women's cycling, women's medicine, you know, around sport, women's coaching, all of these things that need to be covered more specifically to women. And it's just not happening. And then, yeah, I get so exasperated by it. But I don't want to, like, you know, sometimes you can get exasperated and kind of lose hope. I want to actually get exasperated and be like, and no, I'm not going to accept that. Like, let's change this. Like, let me be part of, like, trying to change this if I can. So, yeah, that was my passionate answer to that.
Preach. No, it's the same across so many sports, and working in it as well, even myself, and Dara, of course. You just see it across so many things, but you just spoke so eloquently and admirably on that. I actually don't have anything to add.
The men's cycling is boring anyway. The same guy just wins every race.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh my God, every race is so different in women's cycling. So many different, like, winners. How is that not more interesting than winning a solo attack from like 80 kilometers to the finish, you know? Anyway.
No, we believe you. And hopefully the listeners take an inch of that away as well. And it'll all start with more coverage, or more, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Awareness around cycling this Sunday at the Cycling Ireland Cycle Fest in Dublin Docklands. As I said, you can still get tickets. Registration is still open at eventmaster.ie. Imogen, thank you so much. This has been so incredible chatting to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was great.
No problem. All right, that has been it for Word on the Street. Dara, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Eve, next week.
Next week.
All right, we'll be back next week with more. Chat to you then.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah?
Yeah. I believe in my county, and I suppose they're good at football. They just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12. I love playing 10. I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team. Thank you, France. Merci la France. Merci les baguettes. Merci les croissants. Je vous aime. I love you.